How do you do? Glad to be with you. It's time to go home for a lot of us. 5 o'clock in your nation's capital. My name's Chris Stegall. I am filling in for Vince today. Vince is filling in for Larry this morning. I do a morning show down the street in Philadelphia. Always an honor and a pleasure to be with my WMAL family, though. Happy to be in the saddle today. You want to find me, you want to stay in touch with me, if you want to catch my podcast or listen to basically anything I do away from this radio show, as well as social media, it's all found at chrisstegall.com, C-H-R-I-S-S-T-I-G-A-L-L, the Chris Stegall Show podcast. Hope you'll subscribe and check it out. There's a fresh one today I think you'll enjoy. Supreme Court, it's June, and that means Supreme Court starts getting active. And there's all kinds of Supreme Court onlookers, and usually the breaking news gong happens as the Supreme Court renders decisions on various issues. Today was the issue of Alabama and their congressional map, and what I guess some people are reading as a surprise as Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh sided with the what's considered the left of the court in striking down Alabama's current congressional map. Here to discuss it, help us make sense of it, is Jim Burling. He's the Vice President of Legal Affairs for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Jim, it's a pleasure to have you on. Hello.
Hey, it's nice to be with you.
I guess let's just start from the beginning. Can you tell us what this was before the court? What were they trying to decide?
So what was going on in Alabama is that for many, many years, they have seven congressional districts. 27% of Alabama is African-American. However, only one of the seven districts had a African-American majority. So they had basically one district or one-seventh or 14%, which is about half they would have had proportionally by population. That was the way things were for many years. Now, the issue came up with there's a voting activist sued, and they argued that we should have another African-American majority district to better represent the population. And Alabama said, no, we are creating these districts in a race-neutral way, and if we are going to take race into account in coming up with our districts more than we already have, pursuant to a prior court order years ago, then we would be violating the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. And we think that we should be able to create districts that don't intentionally discriminate, but if we're off by a little bit just the way we try to draw compact districts and things of that nature, then that should be considered to be legal. And so a district court last year struck down Alabama's districting, saying that you have to have at least one more African-American majority district. But then the Supreme Court immediately stayed that case, said, no, we're not going to let that go into effect until the full court hears it after a full hearing, et cetera, et cetera. And they had oral argument on it late last year. And now today it came out with a decision, and it surprised a lot of people because Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh, along with the usual liberals, ruled that the state of Alabama was violating the Voting Rights Act and that it should have and should have embraced the idea of coming up with a districting system or redistricting that had two African-American majority districts instead of one. And so it was a big surprise because people were not expecting Roberts and or Kavanaugh to hold that way.
And is that because, forgive my ignorance, you can speak to it for sure, Jim Burling. Most people would assume that conservatives believe that states and state legislatures, this is their purview, and they set the rules, and the federal government typically doesn't get involved. Challenges to the state legislature, duly elected representatives of the people of a particular state, they have that discretion. Isn't that traditionally the way originalists would view this, or no?
Indeed, that's right. And in prior voting rights cases in the past few years, Justice Roberts has struck down provisions of the Voting Rights Act because they were not race neutral. They were consciously discriminatory in some ways, or they were obsolete. These are statutes that were over 50 years old, and times have changed since then as far as the country's racial makeup and as far as the overt discrimination that occurred in a number of southern states. Indeed, the decision today was based on a 37-year-old precedent called Gingles, which set out this standard that you look to see if there's if you can have a voting district that's geographically compact, whether a minority population is politically cohesive, meaning do most African Americans vote Democrat, is what that basically comes down to. The answer here was yes. And do whites somehow comprise a voting bloc, whereas a majority will vote for a particular party, such as Republican Party. And the court looked at this 37-year-old precedent and said, well, we have to follow that precedent. We're not going to overturn it. And we're going to find that the state of Alabama needs to have basically the federal courts strike down its voting rights redistricting because it doesn't provide enough African-American majority districts. So right. It is surprising because traditionally the Roberts Court has given more leeway to the states, including in some of their prior Voting Rights Act cases. And the court didn't.
Yeah, I can tell you, Jim, I mean, I know it's not totally analogous. Maybe we're not talking apples to apples here, but you look at the concerns over the way redistricting has happened in places like Pennsylvania, something I know well, and the court has been loath to get involved at all. They haven't weighed in when the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania overturns this, overturns that, redraws boundaries, rejiggers the rules for elections. People have petitioned the Supreme Court on this time and again in Pennsylvania, and the Supreme Court continues to say, we'll pass. That's your guys' problem in Pennsylvania. That's what makes this so confusing to me in Alabama.
Yeah, and there's a prior decision dealing with school discrimination where Justice Roberts wrote, the only way to stop discrimination is to stop discriminating. And here they seem to say, well, we're not really discriminating, but we just have to draw districts in a way that have the result that we think is more appropriate. So it could be that Justice Roberts is worried about the controversy of the court. The court has received a lot of opposition from the liberal side in recent years, starting with Dobbs and looking at some of the other cases. And maybe he's holding fire. He doesn't think this case is that important compared to, say, the Harvard school discrimination case, where we're expecting a decision any time in the next few weeks. So it's hard to know what motivates him. He seems to be in some ways politically animated by the reputation of the court and how that could be affected.
Well, see Obamacare for more, right? Ruling it as a tax. And it makes me wonder then, how will he behave? Do you suppose, Jim Burling, were you to guess when we talk about the student loan forgiveness plan? I pray this court does not see any constitutional way to allow an executive branch to just waive debt off the books without Congress involved. I pray, but I don't know anymore.
It's hard to say. I mean, the justification for the student loan relief, as you know, is based on a post 9/11 statute allowing that was designed to have people serving overseas in Afghanistan some relief from paying student loans, a kind of emergency, but the language wasn't written that carefully. And so President Biden decided that, well, this is an emergency, COVID's an emergency, and student loan debts are an emergency, and therefore I have the power to waive that. Now, I think that the Supreme Court is going to strike that down, even with Roberts playing man in the middle in some of these cases. That, to me, seems to be a bridge too far. Again, we'll know in a few weeks.
And I don't mean to stick you in a weird spot if you can't speak to all of these. I've just got a few legal cases in front of me that if you want to defer because you haven't been prepped on them, I understand. I don't mean to throw them at you, but there's some interesting stories in front of me that I thought, while I have you, I wanted to pick your brain. Sure. I'll start with the biggest one, Jim Burling, and that's Donald Trump. It seems people are saying that another indictment could come tomorrow. It seems there's a lot of animated reporting today that a big DOJ announcement is going to come tomorrow, and most people expect that that'll be an indictment. Let's walk through, let's just worst case scenario it for Donald Trump. He's indicted, a jury ends up finding him guilty of these things. He will appeal. This would go on for presumably years, wouldn't it? I mean, I'm trying to kind of walk out what this ultimately looks like, and could it be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court? And then what does that look like? I'm kind of trying to get to an end point rather than get caught up in the day's news of an indictment. Like, where could it go, and how do you see it?
You know, that's an interesting approach, looking at it in the long haul, because I kind of suspect that some of the prosecutors here are not looking at the long-term consequences of what happens if you have a criminal case pending against a presidential candidate or even a sitting president. How would that play out? Could the president give himself a pardon? Nobody knows, because he's never been in this situation before. How would this affect a president's ability to run the country while he's facing criminal charges in various places? Would they put everything on pause until the presidency is over? That's a possibility as well. Would the prosecutors themselves get fired by a new attorney general that the president appoints and have the cases dropped? That's another possibility. It's a real Donnybrook. And when you have a former president being criminally charged, it makes us look a lot like third world countries. Now, I'm not opining on the seriousness of the allegations against the president that may be leveled against him. But I am saying that it does concern me that it looks like some of these third world countries. You have a strong man that gets tossed out, and the first thing is that the successor will bring charges against the predecessor. Are we devolving into that kind of situation where you better watch out? I mean, there were cries of lock up Hillary when Trump was running the first time, and he didn't succumb to that temptation. There are people that are saying that the Biden should be indicted. So, you know, where is this going to end up, and where is it going to go? I don't know, but to me, it's troubling.
Jim Burling with Pacific Legal Foundation. Two more questions for you just briefly. One involves New York, one involves Illinois. They're just interesting stories to me. My jaw hit the floor, Jim. I don't know if you've even heard this. On Tuesday of this week, J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, signed a bill into law that would limit lawsuits challenging the state constitution to be brought in only two counties of the state. That's Cook County, where Chicago is, or Sangamon County, where Springfield is, the capital. So there are rural representatives in Illinois that said, this is outrageous. I live closer to Atlanta or the capital of Tennessee than I do Chicago or Springfield, and I have to travel at great burden to me if I want to challenge the government. Where would something like this go? I'm stunned. The governor just said, you can't challenge me or this government of Illinois unless you come to me in our county. That's unbelievable, is it not?
Yeah, it is stunning, because the idea that if you are a rural person that wants to bring a constitutional challenge to a Illinois state statute, you can only bring that in Cook County or where the capital of Springfield is, where you have such a undiverse judiciary, if you will, that's biased in a particular way. I mean, it's a transparent way to shut down conservative challenges. And the first challenge for this is going to have to be in the Illinois Supreme Court. We'll see what they say about it. And after that, I could see a potential case being filed in federal courts saying that this is it's hard to say what theory it'll be under yet. It could be a denial of a Republican form of government. Could be a due process challenge, but nevertheless, it is stunning politically to be so brazen about, hey, we're going to shut down all conservative challenges, constitutional challenges, and so you can only bring them in very liberal counties. It is rather astonishing.
That shows a lot of chutzpah, for want of a better term. That guy clearly thinks he can do whatever he wants unabated. J.D. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, and then this last one. New York City suing New York counties for not taking migrants. The Democrat mayor of New York, Eric Adams, this week announced that the city is suing 30 counties in the state over their issuance of orders seeking to stop New York City from sending excess illegal migrants to their territories. It's interesting to me, a city suing surrounding counties in the state. Where could that go, if anywhere?
You know, coming from the West Coast, I'm somewhat bemused by New Yorkers fighting amongst themselves. But the fact is that, you know, New York, what is legal basis for doing that? It befuddles me a little bit. Again, is this because Adams is trying to make political points, or does he think he actually has a legal case to require these counties to accept the migrants? I don't know exactly what they're thinking, but it does make for great political theater.
Yeah, it really does. Jim Burling, great analysis. Thanks for playing fast and loose with me today on multiple news stories. He's the vice president.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
You met Lala Kent on Vanderpump Rules. Now Lala and her friends share everything on Give Them Lala.
I'm expecting my second child. Which is very, very amazing.
Congratulations.
To say. Feels
We're
that
all
way.
With child.
You can say she's pregnant, she's knocked up, anything except with child.
Oh, I love with child. I'm going to be saying it all the time. Yep. Excuse
yes,
me.
Yes, yes.
6 feet, I'm with child.
Watch what Lala is talking about on YouTube or search for Give Them Lala wherever you listen.
President of Legal Affairs for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure. Good talking with you.
Our telephone number, if you want to weigh in, 888-630-9625. Can you believe that story on Pritzker? I really, like, that one just made my jaw hit the floor. You want to challenge the king of Illinois? You must come to the kingdom. I will not deign to travel to your rural hamlet. You will come to me. And they pass it into law. I mean, that's just... Jiminy, I mean, that is the most arrogant thing I've... Brazen is exactly right. And I hope, I pray that a court, a higher... I mean, you'd hope that even as left-wing as Illinois is, the Supreme Court of that state would say, that's... No, you can't do that. I hope. Chris Stegall in for Vince Colonnaise today. Vince back tomorrow. Glad to be with you. You can follow along with me and check out my podcast with regularity. I hope you do. My newsletter, social media, chrisstegall.com, ChrisStigall, The Chris Stegall Show, my podcast. Hope you'll subscribe and check it out. Coming up after the news, former Speaker of the House, brand new book called March to the Majority, The Real Story of the Republican Revolution. Newt Gingrich joins us on 105.9 WNMAL. One of the most successful political leaders, at least in my lifetime in the Republican Party. Glad to be with you. My name is Chris Stegall. Not me. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about our next guest. Vince filling in for Larry today. He'll be back tomorrow. Glad to be with you. I host a morning show down the street in Philadelphia. Glad to be here. The telephone number, 888-630-9625. When he writes a book like this, which is basically a blueprint for his successes, you should sit up and take notice. The Real Story of the Republican Revolution, it's a book called March to the Majority, Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, the man who authored the Contract of America. And I will just say, Mr. Speaker, I welcome you to the show, and I don't mean to blow smoke or embarrass you here, but I really learned about conservatism and kind of first formulated what I thought about being a conservative under your tutelage and your leadership as Speaker of the House, sir.
Well, thank you, and frankly, that's why I wrote March to the Majority, because we learned a lot of lessons. I started studying Ronald Reagan in 1965, and I began working with him in 1974. I was a member of Congress while he was president. And then we basically took his ideas and his approach, and it took us 16 years to actually figure out how to become a majority. We were the first majority in 40 years and the first reelected majority since 1928. And I laid out in March to the Majority what we had to learn, how we did it, and then once we got elected, how we spent 4 years negotiating with Bill Clinton and got him to sign welfare reform and the biggest capital gains tax cut in history, and four consecutive balanced budgets, the only balanced budgets in your lifetime that are consecutive. So I think there are a lot of lessons in March the Majority, and I think they apply to right now. It's not really a history book so much as it is a playbook for how we can do it again.
I'd ask you if I could just to grade Speaker McCarthy at this hour and what you've been watching so far, put up against your agenda and your past leadership. How do you see it unfolding right now?
Well, we entered into different worlds. I mean, he,
yeah.
when we finally won, we picked up 54 seats. We had a good, healthy working majority. We had run on a contract that had very specific ideas, and we executed the contract. So we were in a different kind of setting. Kevin has done a brilliant job of recruiting. Remember that he picked up seats in 2020 while the Senate was losing seats. He picked up seats again in 2022 while the Senate was losing seats. So you look at the comparison of the two organizations, McCarthy deserves some credit. His problem is he has a very narrow majority, and he has about 9 or 10 people who are very, very hard to deal with. They live in an alternative world, and they somehow think that if you're just tough enough, that Joe Biden's going to roll over and do whatever you want him to, which, of course, isn't how the real world works. But I thought McCarthy's project of getting to a debt ceiling that actually cut spending for the first time in history was amazingly well done and really was a remarkable. You could do a real case study of how McCarthy thought that through, spent over 100 days setting it up, talked to the news media every single day. And we have a project called America's New Majority Project, which people can see at americasnewmajorityproject.com. It has a huge amount of polling data. We knew that Biden's position of having a debt ceiling increase with no cuts was held by only 24% of the country. 3 out of 4 Americans opposed the Biden position. And McCarthy was able to use that, I think, very effectively. Did he get everything he wanted? No. It's called a negotiation. On the other hand, what I try to tell people, and this goes directly back to my book, March the Majority, and the lessons we learned, this was the first step. It's not the last step. If this was the last step, I'd have voted no. But as a first step towards getting control of the government, a first step towards cutting appropriations, a first step towards a balanced budget, it was a useful and a positive first step. And I think McCarthy deserves a considerable credit for having very steadily and methodically gotten to that point.
This is the blueprint. It's called March to the Majority, the real story of the Republican Revolution. Newt Gingrich joins us. I watched the speech of Mike Pence yesterday as he launched his presidential campaign in Iowa. I've had cause to interview, speak with, be with Mike Pence on a few occasions, even back to when he was a radio host. I like the man. It's clear he's trying to carve a path outside of his former boss, Donald Trump. And one of the things he said that I thought was interesting, and knowing we were going to talk today, I was eager to get your take. He said, I'm paraphrasing, we must resist the siren song of populism and return to conservative first principles. It seemed he was calling out his former boss as a populist. And I thought that's going to be kind of hard for him, isn't it? Considering he ran alongside him. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I don't know what he's talking about. I like Mike Pence a lot, and I've known him for a very long time. I knew him back when he was a congressman and then when he was governor, and I actually strongly recommended him to Trump for vice president. And I think he's a good guy. But the fact is, Donald Trump's populism, as Pence put it, has made the Republican Party the party of working Americans. So if you look at the most recent polling data, the Democrats are rapidly becoming the party of elite academics and lawyers and people who have big incomes and who have, frankly, weird left-wing ideas. And the blue-collar worker who was part of Franklin Roosevelt's coalition and who was still loyal up through Obama has now basically become a Republican. I don't understand. I mean, I think we should be a popular party. I think we should focus on the needs of the American people. And I'm not quite sure, what he's referring to. You could argue that Reagan was more of a populist and Gerald Ford was more of a traditional Republican as a Michigan Midwesterner. And I think that in many ways, Pence is very comfortable in the classic Republican Party of the Midwest. But that's not the party that's now potentially a big majority. This is a much more blue-collar party. It's much more everyday working. And by the way, that includes a huge number of Latinos and a substantial number of Asian Americans and African Americans. I mean, just people who love the country and who are proud of them to be American and who look at things like the Bud Light fiasco and the problems at Target and the Dodgers hosting a viciously anti-Catholic, anti-nun group of sexual weirdos. I mean, you know, people look at all that stuff and they say, wait a second, if that's the alternative,
yeah,
I'm not for it. Now, does that mean that, I mean, Pence wouldn't be for it either, but then how does he distinguish that populist reaction?
Yes.
To from conservatism. And again, in my book, March to the Majority, we really stood on Reagan's shoulders. I mean, Reagan was the guy who dramatically broadened the Republican Party. And he made people feel comfortable with us because he himself had been an FDR Democrat. He'd cut commercials for Harry Truman and for Hubert Humphrey in 1948. And he had a sense of the rhythm. The people who went to see Ronald Reagan movies, who were everyday, blue-collar, decent human beings who just wanted a movie that was fun. And he understood that, and he tried to be a president that made them feel good about themselves.
Yeah, I've been talking with my friends who, and I'm sure you know more than a few of these, who are ready, for whatever reason, to, quote, move on from Trump. And maybe they're very enthusiastic about Ron DeSantis. And I often say, this has nothing to do with being anti-Ron DeSantis. It's about understanding that there are millions of people in this country that feel a connection to Trump. You can't break. That's not even an anti-DeSantis thing. That's not even his fault. There's just nothing anybody can do to break the bond he's formed with so many millions of people. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I do agree with that. And I think what happens in part is every time the establishment goes after him in a corrupt way, and I think in this sense that the Durham report really was a vindication of Trump, and the fact that you have the FBI breaking the law, you have a level really of corruption and scandal unlike anything we've ever seen. So now you're asking people who are pro-Trump to abandon him in the face of the left trying to destroy him, and I think a lot of these folks say, wait a second, this guy's been standing there since June of 2015, just having every vicious, nasty, dishonest thing done to him. And he's still standing. And I think in their minds, they're being asked to betray him. That is, if they switch from Trump, they will be betraying a guy who is and they see him taking the beating for them. And it's not just an isolated thing, oh, yeah, he's a weird guy. It's, you know, these are the people, for example, who now list parents groups as a hate group.
Yes.
And they think, you know, these are the people who watched TV last night when Antifa deliberately waged war against Armenian parents at a school board meeting. And they're going, you know, wait a second. You know, I'm for the, you know, 84% of the country favors parental rights. And so they're going, you know, you want me to side with the 11% who are against parents knowing what's going on in school? And I think that's the depth, and Trump personifies that in a way that it's going to be very hard for somebody else to take it away from it.
Mr. Speaker, by the way, the brand new book is called March to the Majority, authored by Newt Gingrich, The Real Story of the Republican Revolution. It would be, I said, it would be so easy and quite frankly tempting, I think, for most of us, certainly me, in the face of what Trump is still at present facing, to just say, okay, whatever, I quit, I'm out, I've taken my lumps, I'm going to lead the rest of my life golfing and being quiet at Mar-a-Lago. Leave me alone, I'm out. He's not. This Jack Smith thing, you know, it's just the latest deal where he's forging ahead. I think lesser people would just say, to hell with it, I'm out. He's not.
Well, I mean, look, I think all you have to do to explain the Justice Department, if they do indict Trump, is they're having a grand jury in the District of Columbia. 5% of the voters in D.C. voted for Donald Trump. So they're in a community that is 19-1 against Trump. Now, how are you going to have a fair trial? how are you going to have any kind of decent opportunity if you're being tried in front of people who walk in the room knowing that you're guilty because they dislike you? And I think the average American gets that. This whole thing is a rigged game, and they look at everything the Bidens have done. they look at the compelling evidence that's coming day after day that, you know, whatever Donald Trump did, you know, he became very successful the old-fashioned way. He worked hard. He was smart. He did The Apprentice, which millions of Americans watched for 13 years. He built buildings. He built golf courses. Meanwhile, the Bidens went around the planet selling influence to, you know, to Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and China.
Yeah.
And guess what? The FBI can't quite figure all that out. It's so complicated that they're just they give the Bidens a pass and say, "Gosh, well, maybe he got a few million dollars, but after all, you know, Hunter is such a nice guy, even though he doesn't know anything." You know, but I understand fully why the mayor of Moscow's wife sent him $3.5 million, because he's just a terrific human being.
Newt Gingrich with us. The March to the Majority is the brand new book. In our closing couple of minutes, could you handicap this? If Jack Smith gets his conviction or his, you know, his prosecution, he's successful. And like you said, the jury's likely to convict. I mean, what's the outcome here? How do you see this playing out ultimately?
Well, I think, look, here's the challenge that everybody's facing. Trump, in the last poll I saw, was at 53% against everybody combined. Now, if he stays anywhere like that, he's the nominee.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I mean, the idea that the Democratic Party, as a strategy, is going to indict their major opponent, I mean, this is worthy of Venezuela or Cuba or Zimbabwe or Russia, where actually they would have him killed, or China, where he wouldn't even exist. But in the United States, we have decayed to a point where our government, you know, the power of the state is being used to try to destroy a candidate because he is so dangerous, because he actually is willing to say they're corrupt. And I think that we'll have to wait and see. But I think what they're going to indict him on is going to be so stupid and so clearly rigged. The people are going to look at that and go, let me get this straight. Pence mishandled documents, but he got a pass. Biden mishandled documents while taking money from the Chinese communists through the University of Pennsylvania and the University of Delaware, but he gets a pass. But now this Trump guy, boy, he's really dangerous. I think that's a really hard case to make for the American people. And I think the American people are going to just reject the idea that they get their choices defined by a corrupt Justice Department.
March the Majority is the brand new book from Newt Gingrich. We're always smarter and better for having spoken with you, sir. So thanks for your time today. I hope you'll come back.
Great. Thanks.
Our telephone number is 888-639-625. 888-639-625. My name's Chris DeGaul, in for Vince Colonnaise today. Well, it's been a real thrill to be with you today and yesterday. I'll be heading back to my radio ranch. Vince will be back here in the saddle tomorrow. If you'd like to stay in touch with me, I'd always love to make your acquaintance. You can listen to the Chris DeGaul Show podcast. You can listen to my radio shows. You can find everything about me if you're interested. If you've enjoyed the shows while I've been here, thank you. Come along with me when you get time. Go to chrisstigall.com, ChrisStigall. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Getter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. Truth Social. Daily podcast as well, the Chris DeGaul Show podcast. I hope you'll enjoy it. I think you will. Couple of different media hits today, one from Lauren Boebert, one from Marjorie Taylor Greene, both of whom say they've seen this document that Christopher Wray turned over, the alleged bribery from the whistleblower that's been uncovered by this House Oversight Committee. Marjorie Taylor Greene, so I don't have time to play everything she said, but this was her press conference.
You met Lala Kent on Vanderpump Rules. Now Lala and her friends share everything on Give Them Lala.
I'm expecting my second child. Which is very, very amazing.
Congratulations.
To say. Feels
We're
that
all
way.
With child.
You can say she's pregnant, she's knocked up, anything except with child.
Oh, I love with child. I'm going to be saying it all the time. Yep. Excuse
yes,
me.
Yes, yes.
6 feet, I'm with child.
Watch what Lala is talking about on YouTube or search for Give Them Lala wherever you listen.
Today, take a listen to some of it.
This form today shows the pure distinction. This information, this source that came forward, it's a paid informant by the FBI. This has nothing to do with Giuliani. This has nothing to do with the information that he brought forward in 2020. It's totally separate, and it's extremely credible because he's a paid informant. I made some notes after I left the skiff based on the information, and I'll share that with you guys right now. Basically, what was happening there is back in 2015, 2016, Burisma was looking to buy a U.S.-based oil and gas company. And this came from being advised by Hunter Biden and his partners. Biden said Shokin was corrupt. That was around the time of this meeting, was when Joe Biden, as vice president, had said that the prosecutor Shokin was corrupt. They hired Hunter on the board to make the problems go away. That's what they specifically said. Hunter advised that they could raise more money if they bought a U.S. company. So the informant was trying to do the right thing and trying to advise Burisma that they shouldn't go this route. They should hire an attorney, work out their problems that they were being investigated for because they were having other legal problems. And that's why they were being investigated by this prosecutor, Shokin. The informant was advising them, don't go this route. Why would you buy another U.S. company while you're under investigation? That's not a good idea. So he's trying to tell them to do the right thing.
She goes on. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time to play it all, but that's some of the press conference. Lauren Boebert says this is, again, a paid FBI confidential source, they say they have here, evidence that Biden directly took a $5 million bribe. So we'll see. It's interesting. This comes out on the same day, potentially, they're going to indict Donald Trump tomorrow. Which do you think will garner more headlines? We'll be all over it. See you again soon. Vince back tomorrow on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Stay tuned for the great one. I'm sure he'll have plenty to say.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next correction, Richie, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah. Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.